speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, May 17th, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Government corruption and toxic chemicals will bring you a report on the BP spill. Plus, a mosque in Florida is bombed and the media ignores it. And what's behind the whisper campaign against Elena Kagan's sexual orientation? But I can't help myself,
why should I? This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Even before last week's announcement of Solicitor General Elena Kagan as President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee, a whisper campaign had been started in speculating her sexual orientation. A former Bush administration aide and Republican Senate staffer had written in a CBS News blog last month that Obama's then-probable selection of the former Harvard Law School dean to be the, quote, first openly gay justice would please his political base of supporters. The Obama White House has vehemently denied the charges. CBS initially defended the blog post and then deleted it in the days following after the author, Ben Domenech, admitted that it was just a rumor. The subject of Kagan's sexual orientation once again became a flashpoint for media discussion as the Wall Street Journal published a front-page story on the Supreme Court nominee with an accompanying picture of her playing softball in 1993 while teaching at the University of Chicago. Gay rights advocates accused the newspaper of playing to a popular allusion between the sport and lesbianism. Another Rupert Murdoch-owned publication, the New York Post, picked up on the story by running a headline asking, "Does this photo suggest High Court nominee Elena Kagan is a lesbian?" Critics say all insinuations in the media, such as those in the Wall Street Journal and other newspapers, are irrelevant and serve only right-wing detractors who promote them over legitimate legal questions. To date, the Solicitor General has never claimed to be a lesbian or even a gay rights advocate. My guest is Richard Kim. He's a senior editor at The Nation magazine. Welcome to Uprising.
Hi, Sonali. Nice to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, in your piece in The Nation entitled Elena Kagan is Not Gay, you take a look at Andrew Sullivan of The Atlantic. Tell us about how he has figured into this whisper campaign, as you described it.
Right. Well, Andrew Sullivan actually is gay and comes at it from, I think, a perspective as a gay rights advocate, really. And it seems to me that he really wants Elena Kagan to be an open out lesbian so that we could have our first gay Supreme Court justice. And he thinks these questions about her sexual orientation are legitimate, that they might impact her decisions she makes, particularly on matters of gay rights, including same-sex marriage, and that the public and the press have a right to know and ask about her sexual orientation. And I really think underlying Andrew's argument is an assumption on his part that she is, in fact, gay, of which there is no evidence to suggest that she is, in fact, other than these rumors and insinuations that have persisted in the press.
So there are so many sort of dimensions to this story. One is that, first of all, it's really nobody's business, right? And second of all, even if she was gay, and even if the right-wing factions in the United States lobbied against her nomination for that reason, those of us progressives would like, I think many of them think that she is not progressive enough, not that she is either gay or too gay or not gay enough. How do you come at this question?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's only an issue if Elena Kagan decides to make it an issue. And if she had decided in the past to be a gay rights advocate, then that would be a part of her career and part of her legal philosophy. And that is something to take into account in the same way that people's work on behalf of minorities or women's rights in the case of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg were a part of the deliberations about her career. Elena Kagan has not done that. She has not actually, in fact, been an outspoken gay rights advocate. Even when it comes to the question of don't ask, don't tell, which at Harvard, she prohibited military recruiters from recruiting at the career services offices, but then also allowed them to recruit at the alumni office. So she took a very pragmatic route there and, in fact, just upheld Harvard's anti-discrimination policy. So that's where the whole insinuation insinuation that she's a gay rights advocate from the right comes from, that she, in fact, just pursued a policy at Harvard that other faculty members also upheld. Beyond that, there is really the question of her legal philosophy and opinion. And on that, we just don't really know enough. She has been the Solicitor General of the United States, and before that, the Dean of Harvard Law School, before that, in the Clinton administration. And in those capacities, she hasn't really written a lot under her own voice and her own name. And it's these really important questions that I think the press and the Senate should now turn to, and not these assertions about her personal life, which have no bearing, really, on her jurisprudence.
You brought up the issue of minorities. I mean, when one is a person of color, when one is a woman, those are obvious traits that the world judges you by. It's not something you necessarily have a choice, right, to make an issue. You just are a woman of color or not. But sexual orientation is a different sort of minority category, in terms of the fact that some people choose to keep their sexual orientation private and others choose to flaunt it and others choose to reveal it to those who they feel like revealing it to. So can you comment on how this is sort of a different kind of minority category and it makes it very problematic even discussing it, given how the right wing has turned LGBT rights into a flashpoint, a political football in recent years?
Right. Well, you know, to my view, what I wrote is that, you know, the identity gay is something that you choose. It's something that you call yourself and you join a gay community.
Right. As opposed to being a woman.
Right. Elena Kagan has not done that. So you know, there really is no basis to discuss her as a lesbian. She hasn't come out, and we have no evidence to suggest that she, in fact, has a secret life as a lesbian. The point about minority status is that even in the case of race and gender, these themselves were not the subject of discussion when Ruth Bader Ginsburg went before the court or when Thurgood Marshall went before the Senate. Their work on behalf of the NAACP or the ACLU or women's rights were subjects of discussion. But Justice Ginsburg's gender itself was not considered a qualification or disqualification by the Senate, really, in terms of her capacity to argue in front of or to decide cases. And I think that's the same sort of philosophy that we should take across all these matters, that if the category in question is an essential part or even a tangential part of the person's work, then it becomes a legitimate object of consideration. But if it's just something that is in their personal background, that they themselves have not made, you know, a central part of their legal work, then it really falls outside of what should be considered by the Senate in this process.
My guest is Richard Kim, senior editor at The Nation. He's been writing about Elena Kagan and what he calls a whisper campaign that has been out there since she was actually announced as the Supreme Court nominee, and even before that
when she was nominated for Solicitor General.
Right. I'm wondering if you think that her being a woman also invites this increased scrutiny because of the fact that she is not married. She's a woman in her 50s who's not married. And for some conservative older Americans, that's an issue.
Right. I mean, I think that's the fact that she's plays softball, is an older woman who's not married and has a short haircut, seems to me the only criteria by which people actually think that Elena Kagan is gay. And there is a certain degree of misogyny that I think is going on here. Of course, there were also rumors that Justice Souter was gay because he was also unmarried and lived with his mother. And I think what you see here across American culture is this really unwillingness to think of sexuality and gender in a continuum, and to think that people can make different choices, that sex might not be so important to them, that sexuality can change over a lifetime.
Or that marriage might not be so important.
Or that marriage might not be important, or that someone can be married and unmarried and have different sort of constructions of family life. And what you see here at this pinnacle at the Supreme Court is, real sort of, they must be gay or straight, they must be married or unmarried, and as you do at the top of all political life. And that's unfortunate that our conversations have to become so binaristic, really.
It's also interesting to put this whole story in context of the other story in the past week or so, which is Laura Bush's memoir, which has revealed her to actually be somebody who is privately in favor of gay rights. But during the 8 years of her husband's tenure that targeted gay rights, she remained silent.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to really take Laura Bush seriously on that matter. Her husband pushed forward a constitutional amendment to prohibit same-sex marriage, and it would have been nice for her to speak out then. You know, you really, I know a lot of people are really praising her for coming out now, but that takes really a minimum amount of courage.
Now, why do you think, what is the motivation here to ask the obvious question of the right wing to speculate this way or to try to start this campaign against Elena Kagan? Because she certainly is no flaming liberal. I mean, she's moderate, and progressives, many progressives have spoken out against her, some of her rulings, saying that Obama should have nominated somebody far more progressive than her. So why does the right wing have this issue?
Right. So, well, even the Republicans like Laura Bush and, you know, Ted Olson and, you know, have come out and spoken in favor of same-sex marriage and gay rights, for much of the Republican Party, being in favor of gay rights is automatically puts you in the most left camp you could possibly be in American culture, even though we know that's not true, right? So part of what they're trying to do here by whispering that Elena Kagan is a lesbian or saying explicitly that she's very pro-gay rights, which, again, there's nothing in her background to suggest that she is to paint her as a far left radical. And that, I think, is really going to be the tactic they're going to pursue throughout this process, to really depict her as someone on the fringe of the American left legal world. And that is just so far from the truth. She has really hewed a path of centrism and really of sort of mystery. We don't really know a lot about what she thinks about executive power, what she thinks about even her chosen field of expertise, the First Amendment. And that's why I think it's really important that we now turn substantively to these questions in the confirmation process. What does Elena Kagan think about indefinite detention? What does she think about the, you know, what should happen to the detainees at Guantanamo? What does she think about wiretapping? These are all really crucial issues that people have been raising, and she has not herself spoken on her opinions on these matters.
Now, those who justify inquiring about her sexual orientation say that she would naturally bring it up and make it a point if she does get on the Supreme Court. You know, once she's on the Supreme Court, she has essentially immunity, right? It's a lifelong tenured position, and it's one of the most important positions in American government and powerful positions in American government. And there's this implication, Richard, that I'm sensing that she's just sort of hiding her sexual orientation until she's on the court, and then she's going to come out as openly gay, and she's going to be the sort of Trojan horse for gay rights.
Right, right. You know, I just find that kind of laughable in the sense that it really exactly mirrors what they say about justices' political opinions. That they're worried that people are going to be stealth radicals, and that, in fact, is what sort of happened to the right wing with Justice Souter. So, what really is behind all of this is this question of the justice being something that she does not present herself to be, whether that's on terms of sexual orientation or legal opinion. And I think the clearest way for Elena Kagan to really clear this up herself is to present in front of the Senate and the American public a very clear view of who she is as a legal scholar and as an interpreter of the Constitution.
And that, and you're right in one issue, which is that, and I think those who do critique her on the legal issue are right in not really knowing much about her legal background and her legal opinions, which one hopes is the main issue that comes out during the nomination hearings.
Correct. And, you know, even in the realm of which she's written the most, which is the First Amendment, there's some troubling suggestions there. So, for example, the New York Times looked at her writing and concluded that she would have been in favor, perhaps, of the decision in Citizens United, which gave corporations pretty much unlimited rights to political speech. And, you know, that's a decision that this magazine, The Nation, has objected to. And it's interesting to see see, you know, what Elena Kagan does with those kinds of questions should they come up in the confirmation process. Hmm.
Richard Kim, when Sonia Sotomayor was nominated by President Obama, there was such an enormous firestorm of controversy generated by the right. And some of it was similar to what we're starting to see with Kagan about the sort of Trojan horse type, fear that she's going to, once she's on the court, become this flaming radical for the rights of women and people of color over the rights of white Americans or conservative Americans. Has any of that played out?
I think we're starting to see some of that with Elena Kagan.
No, I mean, has Sonia Sotomayor actually justified any of those fears?
absolutely not in the short time that she's been on the court. That is something that attaches, by the right wing to minorities, and I think it's a deliberate attempt to kind of stoke their base, and they know how this is going to play out beyond just the confirmation process itself. It's a political question, and this is going to run into the, 2010 midterm elections. They're trying to delay the confirmation hearing until the summer. So there is a sort of rebound effect that they really want to come out of this with, and that is really entirely political and not legal itself.
Finally, Richard, was the Wall Street Journal irresponsible in publishing the softball photo of Elena Kagan?
I don't know what other photos were available to them. It seems pretty clear to me that they were intending a kind of a wink and a nod toward, the rumors of her lesbianism. I think it's a great photo, and I think she probably seems like a really serious and good softball player.
Well, Richard Kim, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. We link to your articles in The Nation from our site, uprisingradio.org. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sonali.
Richard Kim, a senior editor at The Nation magazine. And we've been talking about Elena Kagan and the right-wing whisper campaign that's been started about her sexual orientation. Actually, it was started even before she was the Supreme Court nominee of President Obama. This is Uprising. Again, our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can find links to all of the articles that we'll mention on the air, as well as to all of the audio of the interviews that you hear. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will take a look at what happened recently in Florida when a mosque was bombed and how the media has ignored it. And we'll also, near the end of our program, give you an update with the BP oil spill, the Deepwater Horizon rig explosion and oil spill, and what's happening right now with regard to government agency corruption, as well as the chemical dispersants that are being used. Environmentalists are saying that those are far more harmful than good for the environment. We'll be right back.
Don't forget your history.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on May 17th, 1954, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled against racial segregation in the nation's public schools. The landmark Brown versus the Board of Education case resulted in all nine justices unanimously striking down the doctrine of separate but equal as a violation of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. The historic lawsuit filed by the NAACP on behalf of Oliver Brown, the father of an 8-year-old African-American daughter who could not attend a nearby white school in Topeka, Kansas, also included nearly 200 plaintiffs from four different states. By deeming separate educational facilities to be inherently unequal, Chief Justice Earl Warren essentially helped to dismantle the basis for racial segregation beyond the classrooms of the nation's schools. Brown versus the Board of Education was an important step in the right direction for racial equality in the U.S., even as the nation, to this day, continues to struggle to find its stride. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. A pipe bomb was detonated outside Jacksonville's Islamic Center of Northeast Florida during evening prayers last Monday. No worshippers were harmed. A surveillance video shows a middle-aged man carrying a can of gasoline and the pipe bomb. Local and state police and the FBI are investigating allegations that ACT for America, an anti-Islam hate group that has been harassing members of Florida's prominent Muslim community, is responsible. Bridget Gabriel, the founder of ACT for America, has made a number of disturbing statements, even claiming that a, quote, practicing Muslim who believes in the teachings of the Quran cannot be a loyal citizen to the United States of America. A man who barged into the mosque on April 4th crying "Stop this blasphemy" and threatening to return may also be responsible. The perpetrator could be charged with committing a hate crime, church arson, and domestic terrorism, and may face anywhere from 10 years to life in prison. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, is offering a $5,000 reward for information leading to the capture and conviction of the bomber. This attack comes during a tidal wave of anti-Muslim sentiment in Florida that has grown following the Times Square car bomb attempt in New York. Pervez Ahmed, a University of North Florida professor, was recently appointed to the Jacksonville City Council despite a torrid smear campaign has faced a slew of inappropriate badgering from fellow council members. One council member declared that Ahmed, quote, would be offended by a prayer to Jesus and therefore was not suitable to serve on the commission. Florida Republican congressional candidate Dan Fanelli is attempting to use racial profiling as a campaign strategy. My guest is Ramsey Killich. He is the executive director of CARE Tampa. Welcome to Uprising, Ramsey.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, give us a little bit more information about what exactly happened last Monday. I just mentioned there was a pipe bomb and that no people were actually injured. Was there damage done to the Islamic Center?
Sure. The estimate is about $507 in damage, but thankfully nobody was injured. The surveillance shows the man walked around what looked like the backside of the mosque and placed a pipe bomb there. And from what the FBI was telling us is that the gas can that he was carrying, that was used as the accelerant. And it was intended to do far more damage. I think that they had the worshippers who came outside after hearing the boom put it out with a fire extinguisher to prevent it from exploding even further. And from what I understand, the shrapnel and stuff like that had reached at least 100 feet away from where the pipe bomb exploded. But, you know, that's what's concerning. It could have harmed people.
Is there any information yet about who is responsible, aside from the suspects that I mentioned? And are they even being considered suspects?
There is not much to go on yet, but let me explain this. Last week I spoke with mosque leadership, and we were discussing the surveillance video that the mosque leadership turned over to the FBI, and they were looking at the footage from April 4th where the man had busted in and started saying, "Stop this blasphemy," and then the mosque leadership kicked him out. But he said when he was leaving that he would be back, and that's something that the FBI was taking in terms of concern as well. But if you look at the footage from that incident and the footage from the evening of the attack, the two men in the footage are possibly identical, and that's something the FBI was looking at from an angle. And I think that the latest thing they did was to get another opinion. They sent it to their lab in Quantico, Virginia, and that's being looked at right now, and we don't have any other information other than that, but I have a pretty good feeling that they're going to catch the suspect in this attack.
Now, is there a sense that this man who came in yelling inside the mosque, "Stop the blasphemy," etc., is there any sense that he was connected to this group, Act for America?
It's a possibility. I think it's too early to tell, but obviously, and this is something you just discussed, a lot of the issues that were going on in the state in terms of anti-Muslim sentiment and what was happening in Jacksonville recently, a lot of that was orchestrated by ACT. I mean, you had Parvez Ahmed, as you mentioned, running for the seat on the Human Rights Council for the city of Jacksonville, and a lot of the, you know, the detractors in the crowd, the people who were making issue with his faith, were affiliated with Act for America. And then you have the incidents in Orlando, you know, in the past month and a half, where many from the Muslim community actually filed a complaint for individuals from Act for America because of harassment they were having in that city. So a lot of the, you know, incidents are in correlation and coincidence with what's going on in Jacksonville. So there's a very possible link, but I think it's too early to say.
Ramsey Killich is my guest. He's the executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Tampa, and we're talking about a bomb that went off outside a mosque in Jacksonville, Florida, last Monday. Are you satisfied with how seriously law enforcement and the FBI are taking this case?
I think law enforcement is, you know, running through traditional procedure. I think media and other news agencies nationwide have not done a good job in reporting the story.
There's very little media coverage.
Exactly. Like, outside of Jacksonville, I don't think a lot of the media touched it. It was not interesting enough, if you want me to put it that way. But I know the only major news network, from my understanding, that really covered the issue was Al Jazeera, who basically reports back to what's, basically the Arab and Muslim world. But, I mean, CNN and MSNBC, it's like these major news networks didn't pick up the story. And God forbid if this was a church or a synagogue that was attacked, we wouldn't hear the end of it. And it would be front page news all throughout the week. Let's call apples apples and oranges oranges. This was a terrorist attack, and this happened on U.S. soil. Why are we hearing stories on CNN about mosques being bombed in Baghdad, but we don't hear any information about this mosque in Jacksonville that was a target of terrorism? This is really shocking in this day and age, and a lot of our community in this state, and I'm sure nationwide, a lot of American Muslims are on edge,
So your organization, CARE, has offered a reward for information connected to this case. Are there other incidents around the country? I mean, we've been talking specifically about Florida, of course, and the atmosphere, anti-Islam atmosphere in Florida. But and there have been many cases, I understand, of vandalism of mosques around the country. But how serious is this case in comparison to what has been seen over the last few years?
Well, this case, I think, is a little bit more serious in the sense that a pipe bomb was used, which had, with the gas can, with the accelerant and whatnot, it was intended for maximum damage, or maximum, harm to the worshippers of that mosque, I think.
So and, other vandalism has not, I mean, other incidents have not been, have been more at the level of vandalism rather than this violence or domestic terrorism, essentially?
I would say this. Look at it this way. This target, this attack happened while the person knew there were worshipers there. It was in the evening for evening prayers that happen every evening. It's a scheduled prayer. And the lights were on. It was active. People were coming in for the evening prayer. Other incidents we've seen where mosques have been targeted, and I'm not saying that all situations. There's been other attacks where, worshipers were there. But we've seen stuff that happened on the weekend when people weren't there, but it was just basically a way to, intimidate the Muslim community, draw swastikas, say kill all the Arabs, set a fire to the mosque when nobody was there. But the point was, it was destruction. It was meant. It's similar to the Klan activity, of the 60s and earlier times when a lot of African Americans were targeted. But we're concerned because we see more and more of this nationwide, just in Florida, without even venturing outside of the state. We've had last year around this time another mosque was attacked in Miami, in the Miami area, Kendall Mosque, and it was targeted, and it was targeted even 6 months before that as well. The same mosque, was targeted twice within the early part of the year, and it's just really concerning to see this these attacks,
Well, focusing back on Florida, it's not just this organization, Act for America, this Islamophobic organization, but also the Republican Party has not been innocent of using anti-Muslim bias in their campaigns. Can you tell us about the anti-Muslim ads that one congressional candidate has been using or has used on behalf of?
Yeah, just last week we had Dan Finelli. Who posted the ads that were basically promoting racial profiling, showing an Arab actor in the film, and Finelli pulls them up and says, "This is a terrorist." That's basically marginalizing a whole group of Arab Americans or Muslim Americans as terrorists. That's not sending the right message. What we need to be looking for is, targeting people for behavior, people who are acting suspicious, and that's what could have prevented this type of attack, happened in New York. Looking for suspicion, suspicious activity. And if you see something suspicious, you report it. But not only Finelli. I mean, last year you had our very own Florida House leader, Representative Hasner, invite somebody of Geert Wilders, Geert Wilders from Europe. Everybody knows who that is. He made some very anti-Muslim films. And he says some very anti-Muslim comments, basically that Islam is not a religion, that Muslims in this country need to assimilate 100% or be sent home. Very, very anti-Muslim comments, and it's really putting this community on edge, and it's not getting any better in the state. I mean, you also have Act for America, like going back to that, that group is basically receiving credibility from the GOP because you have Representative of South Carolina, Sue Myrick, who is going to be speaking at their national convention in Washington, D.C. in June. And we've called on her to basically distance herself from the group because one of, you know, representatives in Orlando for Act for America had made a recent statement at a table at UCF basically saying that they would like to use the Quran as toilet paper and they had no problem peeing in the areas of the mosque where worshipers, you know, clean themselves before prayer. So there's a lot of, you know, things going down the state that some GOP candidates are giving credibility to these hate groups.
And has the GOP responded to CARE's request that Dan Fanelli's ads be pulled or that they make a statement about the ads, the racist ads showing an Arab-looking man and asking if he's a terrorist?
Not yet. And I think one of the reasons for that is because there's not enough of, you know, the general population, you know, from the non-Muslim community giving issue with it, I think. If a lot of people called these candidates on that, on them portraying these messages of, you know, racial profiling and hate and for a certain group, then I think that that candidate would think twice about making that decision. But, you know, we're going to keep pushing on that. But, again, if the general population remains silent, it's almost, you know, you're complicit in the message that these candidates are basically saying, you know. It's going to come down to, you know, everybody speaking up out against these hateful messages.
Ramzi Kilic is my guest. He's executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations of Tampa. Now, is there a connection between the Islamophobia that you're seeing and that the Islamic community is seeing and the sort of anti-Obama sentiment over the past year? Many groups affiliated with the Tea Party movement questioning that he was even born in the United States. Are you seeing a connection between these two?
I think so. I've noticed that, at least on a local level, our chapter of Tampa has received far more cases of you know, incidents of discrimination, and whether it's in the job market or if it's in hate incidents on the street, we've seen an increase in those cases. And I think it is in correlation with Obama becoming president, and not because, you know, he's black or whatnot. It's just that a lot of things are changing in the country right now, and people oftentimes, if they don't like the changes that are going on, they'll affiliate any kind of, you know, any kind of problems or issues with the economy or with society at large with a certain group they already have, you know, a disdain for. And we see a lot of these extremist groups blaming what's happening with the country on Islam and radical Islam and, you know, whatnot. Yes, there are, you know, terrorist attacks that occur and stuff like that, that, you know, a lot of people happen to be Muslim, but American Muslims are being targeted in terms of backlash from a lot of what's happening. And it's not fair to our community. We're American citizens and we're part of the society.
And it's also, I think, should be connected with what's happening in Arizona with the law that is targeting primarily Latinos. And many say that it is openly justifying racial profiling. And all of these things coming at the same time at different parts of the country do signal a sort of a dangerous sort of confluence, if you will, of issues. Ramzi Kilic, finally, what do you recommend listeners do about what's happening in Florida, in particular the Jacksonville mosque bombing? Is there anything that you recommend individuals can do?
Well, first and foremost, I want, you know, and this message goes directly to Jacksonville. If anybody knows anything, please contact our offices or contact the proper authorities immediately if you have any information on the person who's responsible for that attack. And again, we're offering a $5,000 reward for any leads that go to the arrest and the conviction of the person involved in that video that planted the pipe bomb. The other thing I would say is that, you know, if you see anything suspicious, doesn't matter if you're Muslim, non-Muslim, if you see anything wrong, if you see anything suspicious, please report it right away. That's the best thing you can do, because think of it as a neighborhood watch. We have to, you know, make sure that there's a lot of crazy people out there today, and people willing to do harm to houses of worship, to people on the street, whatnot. If there's something wrong, we live in a just society. You have to stand up for what's right and protect, your fellow citizens. Right? And that's basically the message I want to give to the general population. Don't be silent. Don't be complicit.
And what about calling for more media coverage of this incident in Jacksonville?
I think media just has the responsibility to report on the facts, not what's hot. You know, I mean, we all know that if it bleeds, it leads. You know, we got to get out of that mentality. The bombing that happened in New York, or the attempted bombing that happened in New York, that took media coverage all week. It, no pun intended, but we didn't hear anything about the flooding of the it basically drowned out the story in Tennessee. You know, I mean, the flooding in Tennessee. That's the kind of thing I'm speaking of. You know, we don't pay attention to what's important. I think we just pay attention to what sounds spicy or what's going to make the news at 6, you know. I think media has a bigger responsibility than that.
Well, Ramzi Kilic, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Best of luck to you.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Ramzi Kilic is the executive director of CARE Tampa, and the CARE stands for the Council on American Islamic Relations. You can find out more about that organization at care.com, CAIR.com. We'll also link to it from uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, another report on the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Stay tuned.
Coming up May 18th through the 20th, KPFK will celebrate spring with a 3-day mini fun drive focused on health, healing, and the environment. And we'll need a healthy turnout of volunteers for our phone room to take pledges. So sign up today for a phone room shift. You'll be helping Progressive Radio continue to thrive in Southern California while meeting great people and your favorite programmers. Call me, Jesse, at 818-985-2711, extension 513, to set up a shift. Or log on to kpfk.org and click volunteer to find out more. Those dates again, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, May 18th, 19th, and 20th. Your valuable skills and time make a difference.
I'm Cornel West, and you're listening to Uprising with Sister Sonali Kolhatkar on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. And as you just heard earlier from Jesse, our volunteer coordinator, we are having a 3-day mini campaign starting tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday here on KPFK. We'd love to get your participation, whether it's through phone calls, making pledges to the station, or coming in to answer phones here. And the morning shifts especially are quite busy. We'd love to see you here. We'd love to meet you here. We'll feed you, and it'll be a great cause, of course, which is KPFK. And now to our last story for the hour. After failing to shut off the oil gush from the Deepwater Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico, British oil giant BP has now installed a small tube into the main burst pipe and claims to be siphoning off 1,000 barrels a day. An official estimate of 5,000 barrels of oil leaking a day from the exploded rig was arrived at by outdated means and has been the official number used by BP and the government. But a more sophisticated analysis has confirmed that the oil flow is at least 5 times greater and likely to be even 10 times greater. Meanwhile, the Minerals Management Service, which is a government agency, is being accused of foregoing necessary environmental permits for offshore drilling including for the Deepwater Horizon rig. In responding to anonymous reports by scientists who say that they were pressured to adjust the results of their studies in favor of drilling rights, the Obama administration has come to the defense of Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, who oversees the Mineral Management Service. Severe damage to the wildlife in the Gulf has already been witnessed, and environmental groups warn that much of the damage could be irreversible. There is also growing concern about the more than 400,000 gallons of oil dispersant that has been used in the waters. The chemical in question is called CoreExit and is apparently far more toxic and far less effective than other EPA-approved alternatives. CoreExit is manufactured by a company once owned by ExxonMobil, whose executives also sit on the board of BP. My guest is Kieran Suckling. He's the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Welcome to Uprising, Kieran.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, let's talk about the Mineral Management Service, the Minerals Management Service, that is. And this is an agency that has apparently a reputation for being kind of corrupt. This is the agency that is supposed to require permits from oil companies that want to do offshore drilling on environmental, on the impact that their drilling would have on wildlife in the area that they're drilling in. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The Minerals Management Service, or MMS, they are in charge of doing all the environmental studies on oil drilling in the Gulf and approving the oil drilling permit. So they have the authority to not allow any drilling. They have the authority to change the drilling so that it does not harm the environment. But unfortunately, instead of doing any of that, the agency has exempted oil drilling from virtually every environmental law and has just rubber-stamped hundreds of oil drilling permits with no review, including the very one that exploded, that BP oil drill out there, never underwent environmental review.
Now, is this trend something that started under the Bush administration and has continued under Obama, or did it start before Bush, or did it start under just Obama?
They were problematic even before the Bush administration, but during the Bush years, things went completely out of control. Early on in the Bush era, Dick Cheney had a meeting directly with the heads of the MMS and told them that henceforth they will approve everything that comes by their desk and give the oil industry everything it wants. And the agency proceeded to do that. By the end of the Bush era, things were so out of control that the agency was in continual scandal. There were several reports by the U.S. Inspector General in 2008, for example, that found that the MMS was just not even collecting billions of dollars worth of lease expenses from the oil industry. So basically the U.S. government was just giving the oil to free to the oil companies. Then the oil company executives were doing drugs, having sex, and hiring MMS employees all at the same time while they were supposed to be regulated. So it's enormous scandal. The Obama administration came into office right after those scandals, was well aware of them. Secretary Salazar pledged to take action and clean it up, famously said there's a new sheriff in town, and then did to do nothing at all. And
nothing over the past year.
Failed.
So at this point, now the permit that was given to the Deepwater Horizon rig was given to them under the Bush administration, right?
No, that was the Obama administration.
So that happened just this past year.
Yeah. April 6, 2009, the Department of Interior under the Obama administration gave BP a permit to do that drill and exempted it from all environmental review.
So at this point, the MMS also should bear some responsibility for what's happened?
Well, oh, absolutely. They were warned in advance by their own employees, by even BP employees, that without reviews, a catastrophe was likely to happen. You know, it was 60 days before the BP explosion. a BP employee warned the Mineral Management Services that things were out of control. A catastrophic oil spill was likely to happen, and that's exactly what happened.
So even BP's executives, or BP's employees, rather, were trying to warn this. What action could the Mineral Management Service have taken at, you know, after, once the oil, once the rig was permitted and once the rig was in operation? Could they have actually, do they have technically have the power to come in and halt operations?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mineral Management has total control of everything that happened in the Gulf. With a phone call, they can shut down any oil rig they want to shut down. They can cancel the permits. They can order new environmental reviews. They can order new safety devices. They've got 100% control of what happens up there.
My guest is Kieran Suckling. He is the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity. Now, what is Ken Salazar proposing, and what is the Obama administration proposing in light of what has happened and now that it is all out in the open? And is your organization satisfied with these steps that they say they're taking?
Yeah, we're not satisfied. In response to the controversy, the Obama administration has, one, claimed that they have shut down the issuance of all new oil drilling permits. Turns out that wasn't true. They've continued to do it. Just Friday they did two more. And secondly, the administration has said it wants to divide the MMS in two in order to relieve its conflict of interest. And what it would do then is one arm of it would enforce environmental and safety laws on the oil industry, and the other arm would continue to collect money from the industry and also continue to issue these permits and do the environmental reviews. And we're completely dissatisfied by that because the central scandal here is the failure to do these environmental reviews properly, putting out rubber stamping permits. And so under Obama's plan and Salazar's plan, that stays exactly with the part of the agency that collects the money. So in no way has the conflict of interest been addressed. I feel overall the Department of Interior and Ken Salazar are basically at each stage issuing the minimal possible reform it can think of at the moment to try to stem the scandal, but has not shown any interest in actually dealing with this in a fundamental manner.
Now, the president did say that Salazar has announced that the part of the agency which permits oil and gas drilling and collects royalties will be separated from the part of the agency in charge of inspecting the safety of oil rigs and platforms and enforcing the law. Is that a step in the right direction?
It's a very minor step because it does nothing to change the permitting process for these oil rigs. It does nothing to change whether the agency follows its own environmental rules. So I think it's a Band-Aid, and frankly, I don't think it's going to be what happens at the end of the day. Congress has multiple investigations going on. They're dissatisfied.
And there were a number of hearings last week of BP executives, but it seems as though those who are overseeing this agency also ought to be investigated. Is that at all happening?
Yeah, this week. So last week it was the oil execs. This week's hearings start, and they're going to have Ken Salazar in and other government people. So we're going to start to see that investigation turn internal. So I think my guess is that this scandal will continue to grow. The announced reforms will be viewed as inadequate, and hopefully we'll end up with something really substantial at the end of the day instead of this kind of smoke and mirrors, let's make the scandal go away approach.
Kieran Suckling, I want to talk about what BP has been doing with regard to these chemical dispersants. The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, has, I understand, a number of chemicals that they have approved for use in dispersing oil in waters. And one of those is Corexit, which BP has been using, except that BP stands to, and a BP executive stand to gain from the use of this particular dispersant because it's manufactured by a company whose which was once owned by ExxonMobil, whose executives sit on the BP board, as I mentioned. What is the problem with Corexit and the fact that 400,000 gallons of it have been dumped into the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, there's two huge problems. The first is that the dispersant, Corexit 9500, this exact one they're using, it is four times more poisonous to wildlife than oil is.
Four times more poisonous than oil?
Yeah. And particularly to corals, to shrimp, and to oysters. And so you're spewing this stuff that's highly, highly toxic into the ocean.
So what's the point of using it?
Well, many, many scientists are asking that exact question. And an important thing to remember about this dispersant is it does not remove 1 gallon of oil. All it does is break the oil up into smaller pieces so that those small pieces do not rise as rapidly to the surface. They stay inside the ocean. So all you've done is move the oil from one place to another place. You haven't cleaned up anything at all.
What about the fact that birds often get drenched with oil, which clogs up their feathers, enabling them to, which hampers their ability to fly? Do the chemical dispersants at least help birds to not have their feathers clogged with oil?
Yeah. In the short term, yes. Basically, the trade-off is by keeping the oil in the water rather than on the surface, there's going to be less exposure of birds. There'll be less exposure, at least in the short term, of shores. So it alters where the damage occurs, but it does not remove the damage. It just makes the damage happen somewhere else. And I think most importantly, from BP's perspective, that somewhere else is not visible to humans.
So basically, it's a PR move?
Yeah, it is. It's basically saying, make the damage occur under the water where the TV cameras and the beachgoers won't see it. Hmm. That's all we're doing.
And this seems to be in line with them accepting the very, very small estimate of 5,000 barrels of oil leaking a day when many have said that it's 5 or even 10 times greater.
Yeah. What happened here was when the spill started, both BP and the government started doing regular estimates of the amount of spill that was occurring. And those estimates kept going up and up and up, and they got up to 5,000 barrels. At that point, BP and the government said to themselves, my God, this is a public relations disaster. So let's just stop estimating how much oil is coming out because the number keeps growing. So we've seen the number 5,000 bandied about now for a couple weeks, even though virtually everyone in the know thought that's crazily low. So just recently, two groups of scientists using two different methods came up with what they think the spill is. And one of them says that the spill is likely on the order of 50,000 barrels per day. The other estimates that it's between 20,000 and 100,000. So even at the low estimate there, you're talking about 5 to 10 times more than has been estimated. And again, this has a little bit to do with the dispersant issue. Scientists at the same time found massive, massive underwater plumes of oil that weren't visible. So BP can say, oh, it's only 5,000 barrels per day because look on the surface. But if the numbers are more like 20, 50, or even 100,000 barrels a day, and then you look under the water and you see, my God, massive 100-mile-long underwater oil plumes killing all wildlife in its path, it's just a disaster. Mm.
My guest is Kieran Suckling, Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity. We're getting another report on what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico with the ongoing BP oil spill. Now, let's talk about the going back to the use of this particular dispersant. Are there, as far as I've seen, there are some dispersants on this list that are more effective and less toxic. Would those have been options for BP?
Absolutely. So there's a number of dispersants that have been in use now for several decades, and they all get tested in the lab at some level to figure out how toxic they are. And what is very disturbing at this point is that there are other dispersants that have been shown to be more effective at breaking up oil and to be less toxic to wildlife. And those dispersants were not used here. And thus far, BP is being very tight-lipped about why it chose to use Corex 9500 instead, the most toxic one it could find. And so, I mean, is that because the profits from that particular one are more likely to go to, at least portion of it, to BP board members? You know, what are their ties to the corporations that make this? You know, all that is very suspicious at this point, but no one knows what's going on except that it appears that they have made a very bad choice. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, they're using a large proportion of the total amount of Corex 9500 that exists in the world. So consequently, it's very expensive. And when they're done, they're going to be a need to produce vastly more of it. So it's a very tight economic loop they're working in here with these manufacturers. Mm.
And again, to mention, though, even if they had used the more effective and less toxic chemical dispersants, it wouldn't necessarily have made an effect on the oil in the water. The oil would still remain in the water, just be dispersed. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Kieran Suckling, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Throw out your website really quick for listeners.
You can go to www.endangeredearth.org.
That's www.endangeredearth.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Elwin Brooks White once said, "I would feel more optimistic about a bright future for man if he spent less time proving that he can outwit nature and more time tasting her sweetness and respecting her seniority." That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Noor Al-Samarai and Martina Steiner are our interns. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Join us at Facebook.com/Uprising Radio. Follow us at Twitter.com/Uprising Radio and email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. You can listen to the show online and find links, local events, and other info at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening and see you tomorrow at 8. I tiptoe.